Good morning, everyone. The Ways and Means meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. For those of you who were here last night, thank you for your patience. We have the minutes of the April 26th meeting from last night before us. Are there any additions, corrections, changes to the minutes? Representative Carlson moves the minutes. All in favor of approving the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, so our... Yes, sir.
I think with the minutes, we have to thank our committee clerk. We went until midnight last night, and having our minutes the following morning, convening at 10 a.m., complete in our packets, she must have done some overtime, so thank you.
Our clerk, Jean Coddington, is outstanding. Okay, so for the order of business today, we're going to first take up the jobs bill. After that's finished, we'll take up House File 4099, which is the base vehicle bill. After we've taken that up, we will then look at amending the agriculture finance bill, the jobs bill, the environment bill in, and then finally we'll do the state government finance bill. And I kind of had cut off the discussion to that bill last night just in the interest of getting the environment bill done and being able to make sure that those that were waiting for the environment bill actually had a chance to speak and everything last night. And so we'll, I assume, have some more discussion on that bill. Of course, we can have discussion on other bills, too, but that one in particular we really didn't finish the full discussion on, and so I want to let people know that it is my intention to allow that. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, how are you going to handle when we passed the education bill yesterday with higher ed and K-12? From earlier discussions and the action by the Senate, it sounds like there will be one conference committee, so I assume you're going to fold those two bills or that bill into that conference committee. But the structure of the conference committee, how do you envision it working?
Well, Representative Carlson, House File 4099, the vehicle bill I mentioned, is the bill that matches up with the bill the Senate passed yesterday. I don't recall the particular Senate file it is, but those two are the two that are matched up. And so, as you know, any bill that passes one body or the other is eligible for consideration in conference. And my anticipation and understanding then is that the Senate bill that passed yesterday will, of course, match up with the bill that we are putting together today. Other bills like the education bill that we passed off the House floor yesterday, or other bills we passed out of this committee like the bill that has the Health and Human Service bill and transportation bill in it, having passed the House or presumably will be passing the House would then be matched up and added on to that conference committee.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I ask how you'll handle the conference committee. I don't want to mention any wars or overtures or anything like that, but there was a House File 1812 at one time. And the reason I'm asking the question, that was 10 conferees. And the way we handled that then was we had working groups, people that were involved with other articles in that bill that weren't on the conference committee. And they would meet, and some of them took testimony and what have you. We left it up to the working groups to structure how they were going to handle that. And then they made recommendations to the full conference committee. And the reason I mention that, that was, and I'm not talking political party, but that was a more inclusive process by doing that. And that's why I was curious as to how you're going to structure that. And maybe you haven't had those conversations yet with your Senate counterpart, but I would encourage, once you have those 10 conferees appointed for the from the House and Senate, that you have a discussion of how you can be more inclusive of other members. And I guess I would say both sides of the aisle relative to, you know, the division, the finance committees and so on that they would serve on. So there's an opportunity for input beyond the five House members that will be contributing. And maybe you've made some decisions already. If you care to share them, fine. If not, that's a suggestion.
Sure. Well, Representative Carlson, first of all, I have to say I'm not as creative and original as you are in coming up with bill numbers like House File 1812. I just kind of pick whatever the number is that I've been given. 4099 happens to be it this year, but 1812 is more memorable, I must say. Of course, the speaker appoints the conferees. I anticipate there will be 10 conferees. I don't at this point know who they all will be, even on our side, much less obviously the Senate side. And I haven't had discussions with Chair Rosen yet, Senator Rosen, as to those other issues that you talked about. I expect it will be in some ways perhaps somewhat similar to the conference committee that we had 2 years ago in 2016, where I chaired the House side and Senator Cohen chaired the Senate side. But to a certain extent, it depends, I think, a little bit, too, on what is in the bill. And I haven't really seen or had an opportunity to review what the Senate passed yesterday, how lengthy it all is, how it matches up with us. I certainly want to have an open, inclusive process and anticipate that we will have many, many conference committee meetings where people will have a chance to testify and to make their views known. But I haven't had those discussions yet with Senator Rosen.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I wasn't talking about the appointments, the five.
Okay.
As you point out, that's the speaker, although the way we operated, the chair would make recommendations, and most of the time the speaker would go along with the chair's recommendations. But I was talking about beyond the five or the ten that are there, how we can develop, being that it's one omnibus bill, an inclusive situation. By the way, just to digress a moment, 2 years later I had another bill, and I selected a vehicle, and I had a meeting with the speaker at the time, and she said, have you selected a vehicle? And I said, yes. And she said, what's the number? And I told her what the number was, and she said, what happened that year? And I said, oh, Grover Cleveland was president, and it was the year of the Great Depression Panic or whatever it was. And she kind of quietly said, you don't suppose you could find another vehicle? That was the history teacher in me that I was selecting some of those numbers. But thank you. Well, we got another social studies teacher on the other side of the aisle. He'd probably do the same thing. Get a memorable number. But thank you. I'll just stop there. I just wanted to encourage inclusion.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, good morning to everybody. I'm pretty tired this morning. I'm sure a lot of us are. And but I just because we're talking about the process, Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Carlson is, I think acknowledging that there was a year when the DFL put all the bills together, and I think I was pretty new in my legislative career at that time. I'm sure I didn't have any voice in that, but I think that having been through that experience, all of us kind of are aware that that is not a really very good process. And I just feel like I need to comment that the process we're going through right now, where obviously there's been a decision in the House and in the Senate to have one big bill, is a bad process. And the public is becoming more aware of this. This is a process that cuts out a lot of members, even though Representative Carlson is trying to suggest that there are ways to help make it a little more inclusive. At the end of the day, this is something that narrows down the decision-making to very few people. And what we're talking about now in this session is rolling in most of the budget and a lot of policy. The governor said very clearly that he will not accept bills that have policy in them, controversial policy, I think he said. And he's also laid down a marker, no special session. Now, you know, we all know things can change, but I think the public, I hope, is following this and understanding the problem with this process. Yes, it is probably more efficient. But the trade-off, you know, democracy is kind of an inefficient system. And it's that way for a reason. And the problem with this process is that the decisions at the end of the day get made by very, very few people. So while we're spending a lot of time in this committee, a lot of time yesterday taking testimony, debating about different issues, and, you know, personally as a member, I find all of this very interesting. I like to learn about it. I like to see about it. At the end of the day, I'm not sure what difference it's going to make because it appears that the governor will veto this bill. So, you know, certainly if there aren't significant changes to it. So I'm feeling a level of frustration, Mr. Chair, possibly because I am tired. And I think when we all get a little bit testier when we're tired. But I just needed to make that comment because I feel a level of frustration about what we're doing in this committee because at the end of the day, I'm not really sure how many of our, you know, little votes here are going to matter all that much. Thank you.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a reminder that House rules say we're not to refer to the other body or what the governor may or may not do. That's not appropriate.
And let me just say Representative Liebling, I feel that I'm a reasonably good negotiator, but I don't have confidence that I can get this entire bill exactly as it is in every last respect through the other body. So I imagine there will be some changes in the negotiations that take place, and so the governor is not going to be getting this exact bill. And I certainly am committed to working with the governor and with all parties to try to come up with something that is the best bill possible for the people of Minnesota. In regard to, you know, the one single bill, you know, we've done it this way in the even-numbered years with both parties for quite a few years. I can understand the frustration that some people have with it. I, again, am open to people's thoughts and concerns, and I am going to, I'm sure, be sitting through many, many, many hours and days of testimony on this. And if you have issues, Representative Liebling, that you want to bring forward to me or anyone wants to bring forward to me as we go into this, I certainly invite you to do that. As to exactly how the rest of the process goes with other working groups and such, again, I haven't had those discussions with Senator Rosen. We'll have to have those discussions and see where things go. With that, seeing no other questions, let's go forward with the agenda. Chair Garofalo moves that House File 4289 be referred to the General Register. And Chair Garofalo, there's a number of amendments. Do you want to start on those first, or do you want to present the bill?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, why don't we crank through the amendments, and I'll do a quick summary of the bill. And I'll just remind members of the committee the forecast today is for sunny, 61 degrees with light wind.
All right. Chair Garofalo, which I think there's an author's amendment.
Yep, Mr. Chairman, so I'll
move. Is that the A33 amendment?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. I'll move the A33 amendment. I can briefly explain it if you wish.
All right. Chair Garofalo was the A33 amendment. Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. So this does a couple of things. First of all is that we have some additional funding for the Centers for Independent Living regarding veteran services. We put the language in this bill as it was originally authored. Since then, the advocates have come to us and asked for a slight technical change so they have more flexibility in how those dollars are used in assisting veterans. Next, as we modify the child care assistance grants, we wanted to make sure that we didn't have initiative foundations monopolizing the awards from this fund. However, the initiative foundations also do, they submit the applications on behalf of other independent startup businesses. We made some changes to that language to make sure it incorporates that. Next is a provision from Representative Eklund. They just need additional time to spend last year's appropriation. The failure to include it in the omnibus bill was my error. And then last and finally is a Representative Gunther provision. He has found a provision involving the USDA where the amount of assistance we're allowed to get from them is capped in state statute. The dollar amount for Minnesota is lower than our surrounding states. This would conform us to the states that are around us. And then the remaining other items are technical corrections.
Discussion to the A33 amendment. See no discussion. All in favor of the A33 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A33 amendment is adopted. Members, next, I would like, and I guess I should mention, just as you look at your packet, the A21 amendment was included in that author's amendment, and the A18-0838 amendment also was included in that author's amendment. If you're following and wondering about those, why we don't take them up later on, those were actually included in this revised author's amendment.
Mr. Chairman, you said 838. What was the other one?
A21 and 838.
A21, okay.
So those were in the amendment that we just passed. Next, I'd like to take up the A40 amendment. Chair, I'll move the A40 amendment. This relates to a provision I have in the amendment dealing with the closure of the Electrolux freezer plant in St. Cloud, and it's primarily a technical amendment. The A40 amendment first mentions that these services are to be provided by Career Solutions. That organization has now been chosen by Deed as the provider of this services. And secondly, Deed, in an earlier hearing we had, suggested that having related industries affected by the closure being serviced was too broad, and they weren't really sure how they would necessarily identify those, and that it would be better to have other businesses that might be affected incidentally by the closure of the freezer plant to go through their own layoff notice process and thus be notified Deed and then get their services in the traditional way. And after looking at it further, I agree with them on that, so I've included that language. So, members, I'd appreciate your support for the A40 amendment. Is there any discussion, Representative Carlson?
I'm just kind of curious. It says in St. Cloud, and I assume you're talking about other businesses that would provide service, and you're much more familiar, actually, than I would be, even though I get up to St. Cloud a fair amount of time, or a number of times. There are several cities that kind of come together there as one metropolitan area. So does this language screen out any of the other communities that are really very much a part of the economic area of St. Cloud?
No, actually, the way this language is specified, it just clarifies that it is the Electrolux plant in St. Cloud. Electrolux is a multinational corporation, and they have other operations around as well. And so we want to just make sure that people understood it was the Electrolux plant in St. Cloud. The services will be provided to other employees that live, you know, throughout that general area.
What I was picking up on, Mr. Chairman, where it says, and in related industries affected by its closure, that's underlined, and then in St. Cloud. So at any rate, while you're the representative from St. Cloud, I was just thinking it's a rather unique metropolitan area with three counties coming together and other communities that are very much a part of the same region economically, but I understand what you're trying to do.
Yeah, I guess if you look at, I can understand when you look at the amendment why it might be a little bit confusing that way, but the language right now says on page 30, line 19 and 20, to address the substantial anticipated job losses at the Electrolux plant and in related industries affected by its closure. So we're just going to basically say to address the substantial anticipated job losses at the Electrolux plant in St. Cloud, to make it clear that since this is the jobs bill that affects the entire state, to the extent Electrolux has some other facilities or offices somewhere in Minnesota, they don't somehow get confused that we're really just talking about the layoffs at that St. Cloud plant. And again, it's a little bit difficult to identify the related industries affected by the closure. You know, are we going to say that, you know, restaurants that are maybe going to have a little bit less business because there won't be as many people eating out at them are going to now somehow get aid? It's a little bit hard to say, you know, how we would treat that. And so after discussions with Deed, I felt it was better to take that out, and to the extent there are industries that are directly affected, have to have layoff because they're losing a contract they had with Electrolux, then they can come forward under the normal process and apply for aid.
And Mr. Chairman, I was not thinking of the broad, in the broadest sense like you just referenced, but I was thinking about other companies that may have had contractual arrangements in the region. But fine, thank you.
Yeah, and they can be served in the traditional manner that other companies are served in such instances by deed. Other discussion to the A40 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the A40 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A40 amendment is adopted. All right. Representative Garofalo, what amendment would you like next?
You can take it in order that you like, but I would say, I think Representative Baker, are you still planning on offering the A31 amendment or not?
Yes, I am.
All right. I'm going to start with that one.
Okay. Representative Baker, was that the A31 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Baker moves the A31 amendment. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair and members, I wanted to bring up an important part of my work on broadband. I want to support and I want to thank Chair Garofalo for his awesome support on this issue. And the 4 years that I've been here, he's been a real champion on this and supported this in many ways. Early on in the session, though, I did kind of sort of think to myself, we don't really want to do a lot of policy on broadband. We wanted to try to get more dollars out to rural members and rural communities that don't have good quality service. I want to say I really appreciate the work of the Office of Broadband and under the Commissioner Hardy's direction with Dana McKenzie and her office. They've done a really good job in putting out some good grants and following people up. And now their job is following up to make sure people are being held accountable when incumbents are saying we will take this area over because they were challenging an area in a grant process. And now we're going to make sure that the office holds people accountable to make sure that that work actually gets done if they accepted the challenge. What I wanted to talk about today, members, was recognizing the work in wireless and the improvement of wireless service as it relates to maintaining our state broadband grant speeds. 25.3 megs is the sort of the magic number that you'll hear. If you don't have service of that level, whether it's wired or wireless or microwave or satellite, it doesn't matter. The state doesn't recognize it because it doesn't meet the state standards. So what I wanted to do, just mention it today, was the last 4 years I've been looking at a state of Minnesota, and it's been really a lot of red when I see so many areas in rural Minnesota that are not served. And the idea of the broadband project was that many areas of our state are unserved, and so I want to recognize what the work of wireless providers have been doing around Minnesota, the private investments that are happening right now without state dollars, and I want to appreciate and recognize those investments. I will tell you, in my district in Southern Kennewick County, there has been some good private investment, and I want to make sure that when we are continuing to modify our mapping, right now I don't see the wireless companies being recognized like they should. And I want to make sure that we talk about this next year as well. I think that our colleagues on both sides of the aisles are seeing this improving. My customers in my district are recognizing this new wireless service is a very good improving technology, and it is strongly meeting the state broadband guidelines, the 25.3 speed. I just want to make sure that we're shouting out to the Office of Broadband to make sure that the wireless is the next good thing. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to withdraw the amendment just because I wanted to make sure that it is in the works for next year. Wireless is up and coming, but I want to make sure folks know that this is something I want to work on next year, but I wanted to recognize the mapping changes of my requesting coming next year. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Okay, Representative Baker withdraws the A31 amendment. Representative Hurthaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker, for talking about this. I just wanted to echo an email I got last week from a constituent that is opening a business in Grand Marais, Minnesota, and he sent me a wireless message stating that he can do everything in this new business location wirelessly and recognize that we should be rethinking about how much money is being spent on in the ground wire. And thank you for bringing this forward.
All right. Representative Baker, I believe you also have the A38 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can take that on as well, too.
Okay, Representative Baker moves the A38 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, I wanted to bring up an item that I am concerned about that didn't get the time in our committee with Jobs and Energy that I had hoped that it would have. And I think it needs more time to cook. And although I'm a proponent of renewable energy and baseload power, I've sat on the Wilmer Municipal Utilities for 7 years, so I do understand energy and how it works. And this is more about a transmission issue that I think needs to have a little better vetting, and it didn't have, I think, the time it needed in committee. So after the omnibus bill passed, the deletion that I want to do, members, is to delete a portion of a project that's happening in southwest Minnesota. Friends from Great River Energy, who are the largest, one of the largest service providers in most of rural Minnesota. They provide most of the co-ops in Greater Minnesota, and there is a transmission line that is needed with a large wind farm that's being proposed and being under construction actually right now that will be creating 400 megawatts of power. Thank you. And I think what we need to talk about was the certificate of need that was opted out of in this conversation and the lack of, I think, structure to the guardrails that I think might be needed in this kind of a project. But what they want to do is they want to build a 345 kW power line about between 10 and 20 miles long, and it doesn't go through the regular transmission process, and that brings me some concern. There are usually an alternative plan where you create the plan A and plan B, and I think that in this case, my concern is that landowners in this region won't have the proper vetting system and the proper voices that they would normally get. And I don't want to rush something this large through with this large of a project that maybe needs a little bit more in-depth conversation. One of the things I like about working here is that this process is meant to be transparent. And when I get to the House floor, sometimes I don't like suspending the rules because I like this process about how we have to identify this when things come up and when you make a mistake or we didn't have time to hear things, but we have a couple of stops, and this is one of the stops I think just needed to take a little bit more recognition of this large project in southwest Minnesota that has some very large lines going in it. And I think that, again, if the property owners agree to it, there won't be any dispute, and this is the language that if they don't have any dispute on this, on these easements, it'll go through. There will be some vetting. The public will get a chance to voice their opinions on this. My concern is large structures, like what you see along I-94. This is those large structures. If it's across the street from somebody and you don't really have the chance to have your voice heard like you might normally in a process like this, it would concern me that we didn't give those folks a chance to really be heard. So, Mr. Chair, and I certainly have visited with Chair Garofalo about this, that I feel like this needed to be vetted. I know the Chair has a meeting, I think, scheduled next week with some of the stakeholders. What I would hope that we could do today is just sort of park this or pull this out for now, and if they can come to some resolutions and move it forward, I'd like to do that later. But I would like to just ask that we kind of pull that section out if we could to give this process the proper vetting it needed for this specific project. Again, I've got some letters from my local co-op that has concerns about this. Great River Energy has brought some concerns. I'm actually willing to very much work to get this thing done, too. It's a good project out there, but I just didn't want to circumvent, I think, a good process that might need to be looked at in this large transmission project. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll take questions and maybe refer to the Chair on this as well.
Chair Garofalo, do you want to come in at this time?
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. First of all, a couple of corrections to what my friend from Wilmer said. There were 3 days of hearings in the committee that this provision was out there. If there was no discussion of it in the bill, it was because there's just a lack of interest from public testifiers or from members of the committee bringing it up. Second of all, I do believe that we do need to keep working with stakeholders, and I believe that the best way to do that is to keep it in the bill. Third, this is not about renewable energy. This is not about favoring one form of energy over another. This is about transmission. The same transmission changes that are taking place here involving a wind project would apply to a natural gas peaker plant. Next is in terms of the human impacts and environmental impacts. We're not making any changes with regards to those. Those are still contained in the route permit and site permit processes. In terms of someone being across the street from a power line where a person is voluntarily, where the person across the street has agreed to have a voluntary easement on their property, there's still going to be a route permitting process. So I recognize reasonable people can disagree about this issue, and not only the substance but also the strategy of the best way to bring stakeholders together. I'm hoping next Tuesday to get those stakeholders together to have a disagreement on this. I believe the best way to address this is to keep it in the bill, but I also recognize that there's a different opinion, difference of opinion on the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if Representative Baker could comment, a couple of times you referenced southwestern Minnesota, and what comes to mind is there was an issue of transmission lines with the development of Buffalo Ridge. And my question is, does your amendment have an impact on Buffalo Ridge?
Representative Baker.
You know what, the area I'm referring to, there's a huge number of...
Representative Carlson, I do know the area.
Facilities,
specifically to that, and again, if there's somebody in the audience that would, if I'm wrong, I want to make sure I don't get this wrong. As I understand it, this one is more of from the Geronimo Energy Project, which is serving the Plum Creek Wind Farm Project. I don't think it has anything to do with the project you had mentioned. I want to be corrected if somebody in the audience can do that, but this is a project that we're looking at down in the... you know, the Redwood area, Murray, Cottonwood, Walnut Grove area. So I don't know if it's actually connected to that same wind farm. And if I'm wrong, somebody can correct me on that.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I asked that question, that was an issue beginning in 1991 when we passed legislation to encourage or actually require the development of wind energy. And the prime location at the time was Buffalo Ridge. And there was a lot of discussion at that time and for literally a few years after about transmission lines from Buffalo Ridge, and that's why I was wondering if it has an impact. So I'm turning the clock back a number of years, but that was one of the side issues, if you will, when we were dealing with wind energy, and maybe Representative Grofflo, with the hearings you had, can provide some enlightenment on that particular question. And I'm just picking up on when you referenced southwestern Minnesota is what drew it to my attention.
Chair Garofalo, do you have any information on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I do not, but I would just point members to page 47 of the bill, which is one of the sections where that is being deleted. I'll just read it to people. It says, a high-voltage transmission line in excess of 200 kilovolts, if the applicant demonstrates secured voluntary easements of other agreements with all landowners located within the proposed right-of-way project. So people may be familiar that public service corporations, not independent power producers, but public service corporations actually have eminent domain, and this has been provocative and controversial in a lot of places. What this is kind of doing is providing an avenue where it says if there's voluntary easements, then you get sort of this alternative review process. The public isn't cut out. It's just you don't have to set up a redundant route. And I would hope that the committee would agree with me that given the choice of eminent domain being used for critical infrastructure versus voluntary easements, we would prefer voluntary easements. That being said, I understand there's a disagreement among the committee.
And Mr. Chairman, that's Carlson. I'm familiar with how controversial that can be. That's why I used the word impact. I didn't try to steer it one way or the other.
And I would add, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, your well-known bad temper as well. Yes.
Representative Ogenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what I was going to ask about seems resolved, but Representative Baker, you talked about making sure that if these provisions come out, there will be conversations continuing this session, like now, and so I'm seeing you shake your head yes, but I also heard from Representative Grofflo that he has actually structured those conversations for next week.
Chair Grofflo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, pending the outcome of this committee, I would. But, I mean, I'm hoping to have those conversations. I don't have a legislative schedule for next week, but I'm hoping early next week to do that.
Thank you. I think the conversations going forward are necessary.
I always think conversations are good. All right. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the Baker A38 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. The A38 amendment is adopted. Okay, next, members, I'm going to move the A32 amendment. And, members, this amendment is what it basically does is it's modeled after a bill that we passed in May 2017, House File 1732, off the House floor. The vote was unanimous at that time, 134-0. It also passed the Senate unanimously, 63-0. And what that bill did is it said that when the Department of Commerce is doing an audit on insurance companies, that insurance companies that are getting audited have a little bit of rights to, a little more rights than they have right now to notice, to getting a sense of what the exact issues are that they're trying to get to, so that it's not a complete fishing expedition. And I've had information from other companies that are financial institutions but not insurance companies that would like that same protection. And I have seen lists of an incredible number of things that the Department of Commerce has asked for that seem like they're way beyond what they would need for what those particular financial institutions are doing in their business. And so what this amendment does, the A32 amendment, is it simply adopts for other financial institutions in the state, companies that issue money orders, state banks, the same language that we passed for insurance companies. And so, members, I would, and I could go through and give you an example of some of the other things the Department of Commerce has asked for, but it's modeled exactly after what passed unanimously in both houses last year, and so I'd appreciate your support. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I was very active in last year's proposal, and I have no idea where this has come from. This hasn't been heard in Commerce. It's my understanding that it's not been asked for by the banking industry. It's not being asked for by the Department of Commerce. And so, Mr. Chair, the first question I would ask is, why is this here? Because the banking systems are very different than insurance, and while I was very supportive of the insurance changes and actually worked very actively to help make that happen, was a co-author on the bill, this seems to be out of left field.
I don't know if it would be out of left field, Representative.
Okay, right field, whatever.
Representative Hillstrom, it's my amendment, and I'm bringing it forward because I have heard concerns from other financial institutions about the sort of things they're being asked to provide by the Department of Commerce. And I'll just give you an example of one examination request list I saw. Included 63 different separate items that they were being asked for, as well as seven other pages worth of documents. And to give you an example of this request, I'll list a few of them. One, a recap of bank account reconcilements, detail what bank accounts have been reconciled, how often bank accounts are reconciled, date of last reconcilements, who conducted the bank account reconciliations, who reviewed the bank account reconciliations, identify which bank accounts are out of balance or bank accounts cannot be reconciled. Another example, press releases or advertisements issued since prior examination. Now, can you imagine how much advertising some of these organizations must do? For example, there are grocery stores that issue money orders. Imagine how many advertisements those grocery stores have done since whenever their last examination was. A corporate organizational chart. Please provide an organizational chart of parents, subsidiaries, affiliates. copy of accounts receivable and agent receivable write-off policy. I could go on and on and on. And, you know, and I'm not saying that those things may not be appropriate in some cases. They may well be. But I think that the ability of an organization to try to work a little bit with the Department of Commerce in the same way that we're allowing insurance companies to do when they're doing an audit such as this makes sense. And so I'm the one who's bringing it forward. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hope that the banking industry and the Commerce Department would have the opportunity to speak because this hasn't been heard anywhere else. But I think this is actually going to cost the banking industry more money. I think that they may think that this has some merit, but the systems are completely different. And, Mr. Chair, in the banking industry, we want to know where there's fraud, right? We want to know if someone is reconciling your banking accounts or if they're creating fake accounts in your names, which, you know, actually has happened. You've seen the press about it. And so I'm not necessarily saying that we shouldn't put some guardrails on. I'm just saying I don't think these are the ones you want, and maybe there should actually be a working group that gets together to decide what those should be, because I think that the industry would be happy to have some guardrails. I think the Commerce Department would probably be happy to give them some. I just think these are actually going to be expensive, and it's going to eliminate the ability to catch fraudulent account transactions and things that we know have been happening.
Well, and of course, Representative Hillstrom, as you know, because you were very involved in this, you know, the department still has the ability, if there are to show up by surprise, to seize evidence and that sort of thing underneath that bill as it is. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't sit on the Commerce Committee, but since we're apparently making new policy here in the Ways and Means Committee, could we have someone from Commerce come down and comment on this? There's someone here.
If they wish to, absolutely. I think that we had the Commerce Commissioner on as a testifier later anyway, but if Commissioner Luman wants to come down now, that's perfectly fine.
And, Mr. Chairman and members, when you hear the crowd say boo, they're not booing, they're saying Lumen.
I wish.
Well, Commissioner Luman, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, I'm Jessica Luman. I'm the Commerce Commissioner. Thank you, Chairman Garofalo. I really appreciate I really appreciate the opportunity to address this amendment. Again, I'll acknowledge I was a little bit taken by surprise, and as soon as I saw the amendment, hurried up and sort of talked to our stakeholders and tried to really see if there was a big problem that I was missing or something that we had not identified or something that we needed to work on. And I just want to reiterate that I'm absolutely committed to doing that and making sure that if there are inappropriate types of information that we're looking for, if the scope of a bank audit exam is out of the bounds, that we absolutely want to work on that and make it out better. I think the challenge with this particular amendment, and I appreciate that we've taken the language from last year's insurance exam reform bill that was very heavily negotiated between the insurance industry and stakeholders and advocates and the legislature and the department. I think the challenge with this is that the examination of a bank and an examination of an insurance company are actually very different things at our department and very different things for each industry. The insurance exams are an enforcement tool. They're in the basis of a complaint. They're in the basis, when we have identified a problem. The bank exam is actually a routine exam that happens every 18 months for every bank. We work in cooperation with the banks. We give them lots of notice. They know exactly what we're going to be looking for. In the event we have a real problem, then it may need to move to enforcement, in which case our enforcement examination protocol that we've just been talking about would actually apply. But for regular bank examinations, this is actually, and I agree with Representative Hillstrom, we're concerned that this is going to increase the cost for banks, increase the cost for credit unions, and not actually provide any additional services for them. So if there are things that the industry would like to see, I am really, really open to having a conversation about what that should look like and what the guardrails should be. But I'm just concerned that this is not the tool to do that.
Thank you, Commissioner Luman. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could ask the commissioner, so, Commissioner, is it your opinion that if this were to become law, that it would make it harder for the agency to detect when there might be some impact on consumers? I mean, it sounds like the process that's used now kind of helps to head off problems. I mean, let's face it, we just read in the news there's a $1 billion settlement that Wells Fargo has entered into, $1 billion, and that's a settlement over fraudulent activities that occurred over the years. And, you know, that means a lot of consumers have been impacted in the meantime. So if this were to become law, would it be harder for the agency, for the Department of Commerce to protect consumers in the first place? I mean, obviously it's better to prevent than to go after somebody once something has happened.
Commissioner Luman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we, and I just like to reiterate, we take our oversight of Minnesota state banks and credit unions and other financial institutions very seriously, and we have been very successful in that work. And while this bill, I would like to say that there would be nothing that would stop us from continuing to work and address and prevent fraud in our banks for those very same reasons that you've identified, that these are people's hardworking dollars. What I think this bill would do and what I think this language would do is it actually slow down the process that we currently engage in to do examinations and ultimately reallocate the limited resources that we have that are working very effectively now. And so we want to make sure that in no way does the great work that we're doing now to address those issues undermine our ability to effectively prevent and then detect any fraud or misuse. I would also just like to reiterate, and I've had an opportunity in my new role to meet with a lot of our stakeholders and our banking professionals and our credit union professionals, and I actually was at a wonderful meeting with one of our groups, and I gave a little speech, and asked if there were any questions in the audience. And I was really reassured that a banker from Greater Minnesota raised his hand, and this doesn't always happen to government, but raised his hand and said, you know, I just want to thank the Department of Commerce for their diligent work on, nobody likes to have a bank examination, but your team came in, they were professional, they were responsible, they were responsive, and I just think that that's something that you should know as the Department of Commerce. And I just wanted to share that with you as well, that we are really, really trying to work hard. We have a great team of folks that are doing good work. And that the bank examination program is very, very strong and very well respected in Minnesota as well as across the nation.
Well, can Commissioner or Representative Liebling, let me just say, I think there is somewhat of a difference between an investigation and an examination, too, and this isn't going to take away the power of law enforcement and the commissioner to do investigations. You know, it really just puts some guardrails around it, similar to what we've done with the insurance companies. But Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I think that Representative Hillstrom articulated very well. You know, this is obviously something that is a big policy change. It obviously, I think, will have impact on things that really, either directly or indirectly, are really important to consumers. And so, Mr. Chair, if you're going to go forward with this, I think it's important enough that we should have a roll call on this amendment.
All right. Roll call is requested. Representative Carlson?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to see some interconnections here. And, you know, one of the disadvantages we're dealing here with this morning is this is a pure policy issue that hasn't been apparently heard anywhere else other than another industry having similar language, I guess. But when I look at the first page, line 117, it talks about the justification, and then there's a reference when you read on to going to paragraph G, and then it says that it must be limited to matters relevant to the issues the examination will address. And as I read that, you come in and you give a justification for the exam, and I assume you're going to uncover certain things potentially under certain circumstances. Other times you would have, I assume, a clean bill of health, hopefully. But then does that mean that the justification, if you haven't given some reason that didn't include something that the exam were to uncover, you'd be limited, you couldn't go there? With when I look at G, any information requested, you know, and then limited to matters relevant. Well, it seems like there's a conflict in my reading of it between 1.17 and G.
Well, again, Representative Carlson, this is the exact language we used for insurance companies last year that passed 134 to nothing. So if we're examining the insurance company and the financial situations there, I don't think that there are any different issues for these other institutions. I mean, I think that certainly there's the ability to look further into the issue. If they uncover something, they could always start another examination or an investigation, which is different than an examination. So, again, we already passed language like this for insurance companies. I don't see that it would be any different in regards to what you're bringing up for other financial institutions.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chairman, I haven't been on that committee for many years. I was on one that was called Financial Institutions and Insurance many years ago. But at any rate, it's now language that we're adopting for another industry, and I see a potential conflict there that I felt that there should be some explanation of, at least from my perspective. I'm not sure that, in my view, that's really adequate explanation, just simply saying, well, we're requiring another industry to do it. Each time we have new language before us, we kind of re-examine, read the language, and sometimes a light bulb comes on. But I'll just stop there, and it just appears to me that there's a conflict there in the language. But
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to lay out a couple of things why this is very different. Well, for starters, banking institutions are FDIC insured, banks are insurance companies aren't, right? So it is a different animal completely. But let me just tell you a few areas of the bill that lay out that have really nothing to do with the banking industries. For example, financial institutions are done according to a schedule prescribed by statute. Banks are examined every 18 months to match with federal rules, while credit unions and non-depository institutions are conducted every 24 months. So even there's a difference between the two. The A32 amendment says that examinations of the financial institution must not be outside of normal business hours. Well, that situation doesn't happen, and they're always done during the banking hours. The amendment lays out parameters for situations where statements are taken under oath. Statements are never taken under oath during a financial institution examination. The amendment states that examinations must not exceed 18 months. The longest examination the department has conducted that is not part of a multi-state examination lasted 1 month in total. So the industries are very different. The language for guardrails should be very different. And I could go on and on, but members, I was a co-author of the bill that did the insurance guardrails. We should have the people that actually work in this area be working on the amendment. And the industry isn't asking for this amendment. The Commerce Department isn't asking for this amendment. They haven't been part of the discussion about what it should look like, and I think they should be.
Well, members, I want to again say, you know, I'm bringing this forward because I think that, Commissioner, while things are definitely better at the Department of Commerce than they were before underneath the prior commissioner, I'm still feeling that there really are abuses is maybe the wrong word, but that the department is really overburdening businesses in some cases with what they are asking for. And I actually brought this forward not so much to address banks, but some other types of financial institutions where I have seen what I think are abuses in what the department is asking for. And I laid out a few of those examples. I could go on this long list of 63 things that I know one particular business was asked, plus several other pages that just to me are way, way beyond what you would need or anyone would need for an examination of that particular business, knowing what their business is. And so, you know, I guess that's why I bring this forward. I really think that there are still some problems in the Commerce Department. You, Commissioner, probably aren't aware of all the things that those that are working for you are asking of some of the businesses that you're examining. But this is a huge burden, especially when the Commerce Department has the right to assess the businesses at a rate of $91 an hour for all their work. And that's just for the work they do with that the Department of Commerce has. It doesn't include the hundreds, if not thousands, of hours that a business has to put in just assembling the information that the Department of Commerce is asking for in a case like this. And so, Commissioner, I appreciate how I do think things are more positive since you got there, but there really are, I believe, some problems still with the Department of Commerce and the burden that you're putting on businesses in this state. And I guess having now made that point, I'm going to withdraw the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate that, and I really am committed to continue to work on that and hope to talk to you about this as we move forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, I was going to offer the A34 amendment, which is mostly technical cleanup language to a affordable housing provision I've got in the bill. It's a rather complicated provision, though, and I understand that there's still, even over some of these technical language issues, some disagreements among the stakeholders. And so I'm not going to offer that amendment at this time. I think it's something that we're going to have to work on in conference. It's a complicated issue that, for the most part, there's agreement on all the stakeholders, and we had an extensive hearing on this in the Jobs Committee, and I think that there was pretty much unanimous agreement on 27 and a half of the 28 pages, but within the 27 and a half pages, there's some complex technical language that needs to be worked out. And then there is some disagreement on about a half page of that. And so at this point, I'm not going to offer that amendment in the hopes that stakeholders can further negotiate that out in conference. And at this point, I don't believe I'm aware of any other amendments that are going to be offered. So if I can, I think what we'll do is we'll go to further testimony on the bill. And Commissioner Luhmann, you were up here before talking about the amendment. Did you have further testimony on the bill? Okay, why don't you please come forward for that then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I left prematurely.
Oh, no, now we're on a different topic. So you didn't leave prematurely, okay, but good. It's appropriate that you're back. So welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Usually when I say welcome back to the committee, I mean like after you were here a few weeks ago. But in this case, it's a few minutes, but welcome back.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, appreciate the opportunity to talk on the bill as a whole. Again, Jessica Luhmann, Commissioner of the Department of Commerce. We've submitted a letter to the committee for your consideration as it relates to some of the concerns that we have about the bill. I just want to take a couple of quick minutes to talk about two or three of those items. First, we were disappointed that this bill did not include the governor's budget recommendation to remove the sunset of the utility grid assessment. This is about a $500,000 assessment on utility funds that funds Commerce's work to avoid power disruptions in the state, including blackouts and sustained service disruptions in the event of disasters. The request was to remove the sunset and to be able to continue to have this assessment on utility companies in order to continue this important work. Second, in the Article 1, Section 4, the department is tasked with administering three new grant programs for the local government: emerald ash borer removal, energy storage for healthcare facilities, and residential biomass heating systems. Without speaking to the merits of the programs themselves, this is an additional requirement on the Department of Commerce to administer new programs, and typically there are administrative costs that are associated with administering grant programs, and we hope that the committee will consider including those costs in the financial and the budget proposal related to this this bill. And then finally, there are two pieces of policy language in this bill which are also traveling separately as policy bills. The prepaid pension bill and the carbon reduction facilities related to Xcel nuclear plants. The Commerce Department has been working with stakeholders to make these bills workable for both utilities and consumers. However, in their current form, the department continues to remain opposed to these bills, and therefore we would respectfully request that the committee remove these bills from the omnibus bill so that they can continue to be worked on as policy bills separately. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to provide testimony, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Commissioner Luman?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say I want to thank the Department of Commerce and the Commissioner for dropping their objections to moving the PUC to the City of Virginia.
Mr. Chairman,
that's in the letter. I'm
Commissioner
sorry.
Luman.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman, we continue to remain opposed to moving the PUC to Virginia. That is outlined in the letter. Thank you.
I just saw that.
All right, seeing no questions, thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, next on the list I have Commissioner Hardy from Deed. Commissioner Hardy. Commissioner Hardy, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shantira Hardy, and I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the House Omnibus Budget Bill. Governor Dayton proposed a supplemental budget focused on better government for all people in Minnesota while protecting Minnesota's financial future and supporting a strong economy. I appreciate the challenge of crafting a bill of this nature and want to extend my gratitude to the chair and members of his committee for their work to put the bill together. That being said, I would like to just briefly discuss on areas of the bill that will have impact on the agency. First, I really would like to start with a topic you all discussed earlier, broadband. I want to thank the committee for the support of $15 million in fiscal year 19 for the Board of the Board of Broadband program. As you may know, since 2014, this program has invested a total of $85 million and has provided 33,000 households, 5,000 businesses, and 300 community institutions broadband access. While I am appreciative of the proposed investment, I'm a bit concerned that the $15 million will not keep pace with the urgent needs identified in communities across the state. The recommendation in the bill would expand access to about 5,000 households, businesses, and community institutions. Governor Dayton's budget recommended $30 million in fiscal year 19 for the program, which would serve approximately 11,000 households, businesses, and community organizations. I encourage you to find additional money, if you can, Mr. Chair, to increase funding to the program and to meet the governor's level to ensure that Minnesota families and businesses are able to compete. The next area I just want to touch on is the cuts to the Minnesota Investment Fund and the Job Creation Fund. It is important that Minnesota has a fully funded complement of economic development tools to support job creation and business expansion throughout our state. Minnesota's incentive programs like MIF and JCF are already modest to our companion states, yet they remain critical components for community and business competitiveness, especially in greater Minnesota. The bill cuts MIF by $5 million for fiscal year 19 and earmarks a further $3.5 million in fiscal year 19, leaving only $4 million on the bottom line to support business expansion and relocation in the state. Since 2011, MIF has provided more than 102 businesses, helping them add a projected 9,000 jobs throughout the state, leveraging more than $1.5 billion in private investment. Some recent investments include Articac and DigiKey in Thief River Falls, Ceres Industries in Duluth, Ice Castle Fist Houses in Grand Rapids, Prime Pork in Windham, and Viracon in Owatonna, just to name a few. Furthermore, the bill goes on to cut our other investment program the job creation fund by $7 million for fiscal year 19, reducing the program to $1.5 million and reducing the base to $5 million in fiscal year 21. JCS has provided more than 84 projects statewide since 2014, 43 in the Twin Cities and 41 in Greater Minnesota, creating 5,000 jobs, retaining 96, and leveraging approximately $1 billion in total investments. I must tell you that the Job Creation Fund is fully subscribed for this fiscal year, and we will be making multiple awards this week and our last ones in May, so we are out of money. Notable recent fundings for JCF has been the Blattner Energy and Avon, North Star Mutual Insurance, Anderson Crane Company in Litchfield, Capital Safety in Red Wing, just to name a few. With a budget surplus, these critical resources should not be cut, and carve-outs should be limited. Minnesota, if these cuts move forward, will be left with few dollars to compete now and into the future. The last couple areas that I want to discuss is just a couple appropriations. The governor recommended funding for $2 million for a paper mill in Duluth and resources for three organizations, the Family Partnership in the amount of $1.4 million, Family Tree Clinic for $900,000, and Tubman Center for $383,000. This funding would allow these organizations to upgrade, expand, and renovate their facilities that provide better services throughout Minnesota. I encourage you to include that language in the bill. A couple technical issues that I'm hoping that the chair would do is there are a number of places in the bill where the appropriation is actually coming from the wrong fund, and so I'm hoping that we can update those areas. For example, there is a provision in there for a grant going to Advocating Change Together. That should come from our vocational rehabilitation program within the workforce development budget. It's going to be very critical that we make those changes because we won't be able to perform on those projects because they will be coming from the wrong budget area. So in conclusion, with the year-over-year budget surplus, we have the opportunity to make strong investments in our workforce, in our businesses, and our communities. I know that the committee has challenging work and little time ahead, but know that our department is committed to working with you to develop a budget and programs and services that will strengthen Minnesota's economy. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, any questions at all? Thank you, Commissioner. Next, we have Commissioner Tingerthal. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Tingerthal. I'm commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to address the committee. We have submitted a letter, which is available to the committee, that has detailed comments, and I'd like to highlight just a couple of those items. First, we appreciate that the bill includes funding for a program called Homework Starts with Home. This was at a smaller amount than the governor included in his budget message, but we appreciate that there is an item here since the committee was only able to provide a one-year appropriation last year, and this is a program that is underway. And it has demonstrated through research that we've conducted with the Department of Education that it does provide stability for families that have been homeless and highly mobile. And this appropriation will allow us to expand that program beyond the cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Moorhead. We hope that you will find the opportunity to increase the base funding on this. With regard to the section that Chair Knobloch described about tax-exempt bonds, we do have several concerns with that section, which is Article 4, Section 12. We are comfortable with five items that are included in that section that were worked out between last session and this session with a group of stakeholders across last summer and last fall. Those items are included in the bill. We do urge the chairman to continue to work on the A34 amendment. This includes some technical corrections, or I should say changes, that we worked on together with MMB, which actually administers this section, that will actually ease the operation of the program and make it work more effectively. We have discussed this with a number of the sponsors of this section and have not heard the objections that the chair referred to, but we are committed to continue to work on those technical amendments because we think these changes are a good set of changes to be made, and that with these few additional technical changes that it will improve the way in which funds are allocated to affordable housing and will increase the number of units that are able to be produced. So wanna, it is complex, but we do need to make those changes. We remain concerned about two additional items in the bill that were not agreed to by the group that worked over the summer and fall. The first of these is in Article 4, Section 12, lines 60.3 to 60.14. It requires the agency to essentially automatically allocate federal tax credits to any project that has received tax-exempt bonds through an allocation that's administered through MMB. Minnesota Housing is actually the agency that is designated to administer this federal tax credit program and has been so designated for the last 30 years. And this language says that these particular projects shall be deemed to have met the requirements of what's called our qualified allocation plan, which is actually a plan that we amend every year in a very, very public process that sets the priorities for the projects and the minimum standards for projects. And those minimum standards include things like assuring that we are looking at the cost of the projects that are allowed to move forward with federal tax credits. These are all things that are required of us under the federal law, and we believe that complying with this provision would actually put us out of compliance with federal law in exercising those obligations that are assigned to us. The second provision that we are concerned about is, again, in Article 4, Section 21, lines 64.18 and 19. This removes a set-aside for use of these bonds as homeownership for a period of 2 years. We use this set-aside to run something that's called the Minnesota Cities Participation Program. This is a program where cities actually apply to us and say, we would like a set-aside of the mortgage loans that you support with these bonds in order to focus on homeownership in our communities. It's used by communities throughout the state and very much by municipalities in both the metro area and in greater Minnesota to provide homeownership opportunities for their residents. And we are concerned that if we are not able to access the set-aside that's eliminated in lines 64.18 and 19, that we run the risk of not having the level of funding that's requested and made available now for those cities. We're pledged to continue to work with Chair Knobloch and the other stakeholders to see if we can't reach a compromise on our concerns.
Thank you, Commissioner Stingerthal, and thank you for all the work that you have done on this very comprehensive affordable housing bill that is in this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions of Commissioner Stingerthal? Thank you, Commissioner. Discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Wagenius.
Well, I think I just want to comment on a couple of the energy things that have not been emphasized in this bill. There is one really nice energy thing, and that is there's $40 million from the RDA that goes to Prairie Island for their net zero project. I think that's creative, and good job, Representative Garofalo. There are two really bad things in this bill. One, for those of us who are XL ratepayers, there is a guarantee to the shareholders that they will not have to pay for cost overruns for capital investments in the nuclear plants. So if shareholders are held harmless, that means ratepayers are the ones that will have to pay. And on behalf of my ratepayers, because all of my citizens and that I represent are XL ratepayers, I really object to that provision. And the second one is different, or my second objection, is there was an agreement made between XL Energy and the state that they would set aside money for every cask that was put on Prairie Island. That was one of the most hard-fought agreements in this state. And this bill breaks that agreement. And I think it reflects really poorly on XL Energy. And we don't want corporations to be we don't want that tension where we can't trust corporations and trust their word. And so I think that is a provision that needs to be removed from this bill. There are things that that money is not needs to increase our clean energy goals. But the more important thing is not breaking agreements like this one is being broken. So, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to highlight those because those issues have not been highlighted in our testimony, in the testimony.
I want to interrupt the debate on the bill because I've been informed that the Commissioner of Labor and Industry wants to testify. We didn't have him on our original list, but I want to give him the courtesy of coming up. So if we can interrupt the debate a little bit and welcome back the commissioner from last night.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize to members who put anything on the list, so I apologize. And thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Ken Peterson, Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. We have there's a lot of good things in this bill for the Department of Labor and Industry, and I want to acknowledge that to Chairman Garofalo and his committee. They've passed the OSHA conformance bill, gave us additional money for youth skills partnerships and for wage step and forth, and we do appreciate that. Just two items I wanted to mention very quickly, and that is one that I testified last night, that is the rulemaking changes for residential building codes. And I know the goal of Representative Vogel and others backing the bill is simply to make housing more affordable. We don't think it's going to succeed. We don't believe it works. I referred to my testimony last night. The other issue I want to speak to is just on the issue of the new two-tiered penalties, the two-tiered minimum wage. What it does is actually lower the minimum wage or the real minimum wage for servers who are tipped employees who make more than $14 an hour in tips. We think it's going to be hard to enforce. It's going to be hard to deal with for restaurant owners. But more important, we don't think that you grow an economy by cutting wages. It just doesn't work. Never has worked. It won't work in the future. And with that, I complete my comments. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Commissioner Peterson? See no questions. Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, back to discussion on the bill. Representative Carlson, then Hillstrom.
Mr. Chairman, I want to follow up the comments by Representative Wagenius relative to the what was then NSP, now Excel, agreement relative to the nuclear storage and the cask issue and renewable energy. Some of you have heard me on the House floor on this issue before, but I was one of the conferees, and we were literally day after day, all night many times, trying to resolve that issue of nuclear storage. And quite frankly, the breakthrough was when we were able to get the Senate to accept the concept of developing renewable energy. And I was the proponent at the time of and offered up that it would be $500,000 per cask that would go in per year that would go into the renewable energy fund. And along with that, then, was the requirement that they develop 450 megawatts of wind energy. I referenced Buffalo Ridge earlier, and that's one of the reasons I was interested in another 50 megawatts in biomass. But truly, the renewable energy fund was the breakthrough. And that was a key part of that agreement. And now that's being violated in this particular bill. And I just want to alert people to the fact that that was a very contentious issue and a very difficult issue to resolve. The community was very divided on the storage of nuclear waste. And that was one thing that was done to, even though it was very sensitive when we did have that breakthrough, in terms of the acceptance of it in various communities. Some were advocating no storage, some were willing to accept storage under certain conditions, and some wanted it wide open. But the breakthrough was the Renewable Energy Development Fund. And so I'm very disappointed, not because I was one of the architects of that at the time, but I'm very disappointed to see the violation of that agreement, because the storage of nuclear waste is still not resolved. And we're still in vital need of developing alternative energy. And I would say that that fund, in a major way, along with the mandate at the time, contributed greatly to the beginning of the growth and expansion of alternative energy sources in the state of Minnesota. So I'll stop there and just leave it at that I'm kind of disappointed to see this language before us. Not kind of, very disappointed, quite frankly.
Representative Hillstrom, then Hornstein. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm very opposed to the tip penalty that's in this bill. So I think it's a bad thing when you inject the employer into whether or not customers give tips to the servers and how much that should be in caps. The, I mean, it basically makes it so that it doesn't matter whether you're a good server or a bad server, because you're going to have to share your wages and your employer is going to get to decide whether or not the back of the house staff gets to make some of the money from your tips. And right now that's done based on employers are prohibited from doing that. We all know that folks who are in the service industry are some of the lowest paid workers that there are. And you give good service and you get good tips, and I don't think that the employer should get to lower your wages based on how good of a server you happen to be. I think it's the wrong thing to do. Servers are already struggling to get by, and I don't know why we would want to insert the employer into that relationship. So I know many, many family members and neighbors and friends who have served folks even, you know, after they've graduated college or got their law degrees. As we have some public defenders that we hear from that work as servers in order to supplement their income so that they can make a living at some of the lower paid, even professional jobs. And what you're saying by creating this two-tiered minimum wage system is that we just don't value your service to Minnesotans as much as we value everyone else's, and I think that's wrong. And so I'm a no.
Representative Hornstein.
Hi. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions for the author. They're both on dealing with sections on page 11, and it relates to the nuclear waste sections that my colleagues have previously alluded to. So on page 11, lines 7 and 8, there's discussion of $1 million to conduct a study on nuclear waste transportation, and it's discussing an evaluation of alternative modes of transportation. My understanding, you know, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission actually has maps of where the waste would be transported through Minnesota en route to Yucca Mountain. Now, we know Yucca Mountain has been shelved, but what would be an example of an alternative mode of transporting nuclear waste? I think it's usually truck or rail, from my understanding, but are there alternatives to truck or rail?
Chair Garofalo. Mr. Chairman and Representative Hornstein, we found out there's a tunnel system under Minneapolis. We're planning on moving it to there, if that's all right. No. It is primarily train, truck when the train is not accessible. And I should correct you on one thing that, you know, spent nuclear fuel is already transported across the United States of America when from a military capabilities, so aircraft carriers and submarines. We just don't know about it. And so the idea that they're that traveling spent nuclear fuel traveling across the country is somehow new. It's been happening for many years, and people might be surprised where, in fact, it gets transported from if they were able to get the information from the Department of Defense. So, but the short answer is yes.
Representative Horstein.
Right, I'm aware of that, but I think we're talking about volumes much greater. So, are you suggesting submarines in the Mississippi River? I mean, what is the alternative? The alternative to truck and rail. You mentioned truck or rail.
No, so
I could see it going down to the Gulf, and then who knows, right?
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, that's what the spent nuclear fuel currently from the Department of Defense is coming from. Is from nuclear powered submarines. Right. And aircraft carriers. In terms of the forms of transportation, you're correct that there's been a very formal process where the federal government has failed to live up to their responsibilities to provide a permanent repository. What's happening now is that interim facilities are being researched and developed with local support in locations, it's southeastern New Mexico, western Texas, that are being looked at. And unlike the permanent process, which has a more formalized order of operations of who's going to go first, this is an opportunity to move the Prairie Island and Monticello locations up the chart to get to the list, to get to the front of the chart, the list, so that we know that I don't think there's no pro keep the spent nuclear fuel in Minnesota constituency group, and this is an opportunity to get that stuff out of here.
Thank you, Representative Horn. Well, that was a very good transition to my next question. Which relates to the following section. So this is lines 13, 14, and 15. And again, this is a study for private parties to research an interim storage facility. Again, back when Yucca Mountain, the process to establish Yucca Mountain started, there were a number of different sites. You had mentioned New Mexico, and I think there were some sites in Utah. But interestingly, there were sites in northern Minnesota that were considered. There's granite geology up there that some have found conducive to that. I think at one time we were looking at storing hazardous waste up in North Home and Coochachin County. So if, for example, one of these independent private parties decided to look at northern Minnesota as a possible site for nuclear waste, would that be allowable or under this provision?
Chair Garofalo. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, we can't get a replacement oil pipeline built in the state of Minnesota after 3 years, and you think we're going to try to put spent nuclear fuel up on the Iron Range?
Yeah.
question kind of answers itself, Representative.
At one time that was seriously considered. So I think that we have to be very careful about this issue. And I think one of the real concerns about nuclear power, and, you know, we're extending the life of those plants in this in this bill is, you know, we still have no solutions to this after 50 years, and we're talking about the one of the most hazardous forms of waste that we've generated in our industrial society. So, and long term hazardous. So, again, you know, we have to be very careful about this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think something that we would all agree on is that where the spent nuclear fuel is right now is not ideal. We'd be far better situated in a community that has local support, whether it's an interim or permanent facility, and a place that has no water and is geologically stable. And anywhere would be better than where it is right now, regardless of your views on nuclear power. And that's what this bill is attempting to do.
And one last comment on that, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hornstein.
And the fact that we continue to be producing this, you know, when we have no place safe to store it, as you point out, I think is also very problematic, and I hope we can agree on that as well.
I have Representatives Baker, Wagenius, and Carlson. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to give my thanks to Chair Garofalo for having a great bill that's put forward. We had some of our best conversations, in-depth conversations about some really tough issues this year. I give a lot of credit to the nuclear conversation that Representative O'Neill brought forward to us, and 3.5 hours of a very good conversation. I think it produced a lot of very good information. I just wanted to also thank the chair for recognizing the two-tiered minimum wage. It seems like we all want to think that we're taking money away from people, and yet what we saw this year, and again, I think I give the committee a lot of credit. I think we had a 2.5 hour conversation just on this issue, where we heard from both servers in favor of a tipped credit or a two-tiered wage system and some that were not in favor of that. We have 8,000 members of a new group called the Minnesota Restaurant Workers of America, and there's 8,000 members in Minnesota all of a sudden. And I'm a restaurant owner, so I want to make sure that we start having this conversation that full-service restaurants will not be able to sustain themselves in the future if we don't recognize the real wages that our servers are and our bartenders are making. I will tell you that my servers and my bartenders work very hard, and they're worth every penny they get. I have members that are employees that are making a minimum of $18 an hour for the lunch crowd. Most of them are making in that $25 to $35 an hour range every 2 weeks. And I put on their paycheck what their wages are with their tips and with their minimum wage. So they really do recognize, in my company anyway, what their real wages are. I don't get where we're getting the penalty on this. I think that to think for a minute that we would, if we did this, get this to go forward and it stopped at that level, so we could increase other wages for employees in the back of the house and other employees that don't get those tips, this is something that we have to start talking about. Because I will tell you that counter service is coming and iPads are coming, and I just want to make sure that we need to stand up for full-service restaurants in the future. This isn't going to work the way we're doing it now in Minnesota. If you start comparing our burger prices to our upper Midwest, it's a big difference. So I just want to stand up for the folks that are coming together in our industry as workers to say we also have a voice, and they are concerned as well. So I appreciate the comments, but I also want to thank the chair for including this in his bill.
Representative Wagenius.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just got a note that PCA was a provision was put in this bill that did not have a hearing. It's a new provision, and they would like to testify.
We weren't alerted to them wanting to testify before, Representative Wagenius. I guess if they...
Mr. Chair?
Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And if PCA wants to, I mean, it would... This should be sending a note to you or to the committee administrator. I think that's really inappropriate. Thank you.
Well, actually, we did, you know, we were sent a note not long ago that they were requested to testify, and given they testified last night and had not previously requested to testify, I didn't think that they maybe needed to testify now. But if you're going to request them to testify, Representative Wagenius, I'll bring them forward.
Thank
if Commissioner Stein must be here somewhere. Or someone from the PCA.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was an additional provision, not...
How are you? Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Shannon Lothammer. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Water at the Pollution Control Agency. Commissioner Stein is actually traveling the state today, speaking with wastewater treatment operators about wastewater treatment and permitting. So he regrets his inability to be here. He was here last evening, as you had noted. And I do appreciate the opportunity to testify. Just real briefly, I should acknowledge to Chairman Garofalo, too, that I apologize that I wasn't able to speak with him prior to my testimony this morning. The agency does wish to express concerns with the appropriation and language included in lines 5.29 to 6.25 of this bill. Those concerns are more detailed in this letter from Commissioner Stein that was distributed to the committee, I believe, this morning. But just very briefly, our concerns are threefold. This language sets up a system of unequal access to the regulatory and permitting process. It creates delays in the permitting process, and it adds a redundant step to the stakeholder input process for rulemaking and permitting. To the first point, currently citizens and stakeholder groups that provide their input to the agency during regulatory decision-making and permitting do so without the financial support of the general fund. House File 4289 would change that by funding the Minnesota Environmental Science and Economic Review Board, or MESRB, to participate in this existing public process. But because MESRB is only one of many stakeholders that have a strong interest in the Pollution Control Agency's work, this appropriation creates a fairness issue. For example, there's nearly a dozen joint powers organizations that regularly participate in our work, and those are actually detailed in the commissioner's letter. Secondly, the new process that would be funded with this appropriation would serve only to slow down our permitting work, and this is at a time when we're working very hard to streamline our services and improve efficiencies to deliver the speed of service that Minnesotans expect. Thirdly, this sets up a new layer of review for one stakeholder group in duplication of current law and practice. That includes public comment and hearing for rulemaking efforts. These are existing public opportunities, pre-public notice to permittees, and public notice and comment for all of our permitting processes, provisions for requesting and granting a contested case hearing on agency decisions, and also provisions for judicial review of agency decisions, such as permit issuance, all of which already exist in Minnesota statutes and rules. So by creating that fairness issue, by slowing down the permitting process, and by adding redundant review, this language and appropriation has the potential to create mistrust and controversy rather than the creative problem-solving and collaborative approaches that we need to truly achieve our water quality goals in a cost-effective manner. And those would be the creative approaches such as the information that's included in Article 6 of the bill on page 94, which represents an effort that we've been working collaboratively with the Alexandria Lakes Area Sanitary District and the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities to develop an approach to meeting some phosphorus reduction needs that the sanitary district has, but in a much more cost-effective and creative approach. So because of the potential roadblocks that this language in lines 5.29 to 6.25 would create towards that collaboration and partnership, we do oppose those lines of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. And again, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Okay, back to discussion to the bill. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I've got two areas I just wanted to, one I want to comment on and then ask. When Rep. Sam Hornstein was talking about potential storage sites in Minnesota, back when I was one of the conferees, there was conversation about sites in Minnesota, northern part of the state because of granite deposits. Mr. Chairman, what's the nickname of your city?
Oh, the Granite City.
Well, I don't think St. Cloud has ever talked about, but farther north, there apparently were conversations in some entities about potential storage. And I did have a conversation with the Speaker of the House at the time, and when I was appointed to the conference committee, and he said, I know you're going to have to reach a compromise, but I have one request. He said, no storage in Coochaching County. And to give you an idea of where those conversations were and what different entities, I don't know if it was NSP or whoever was looking at potential storage sites, but at any rate, Representative Hornstein pointed out what was a real issue when you start talking about alternative storage. The other question that I had, and it's of Representative Groffel, I'm looking at the language dealing with the tipped employees, and we have a lot of conversation about restaurant employees because they're by far the largest group. But as I read the language, it appears that this would cover other tipped employees as well. What comes to mind would be airport, railroad, hotel. There are a lot of different jobs that the employees do rely on tips, and it would appear from the language on 88.29, it says employees receiving gratuities means an employee who customarily and regularly receives more than $30 per month in gratuities. So I'm assuming that the impact is much broader than what the conversation was so far this morning about the restaurant employees. And as important as that group is, because I'm sure that they are by far the largest, but there, my point is that there are other employees out there that would be impacted as well. And I would want to know if you concur with my interpretation of the language or not.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, no, I don't concur with your definition of the language because each of the sectors you make is exceptionally rare that someone would make $9.65 an hour.
Rare, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I have no idea what, for example, a doorman or a door person might receive. That's a tipped employee at a hotel. The people who work cleaning those rooms, many of the patrons of those hotels, motels, will leave a gratuity. And I suspect that we're talking about people that are in the category that you're describing here in that instance. You're probably right, an airport employee, while they may or may not, depending on whether they're a union employee or not, I'm not sure that, for example, the cleaners that come in and clean the airplanes at airports, I don't know if they are receiving the minimum wage or something higher. But I think but what you just said most, but there are some out there that are going to be impacted that are outside the restaurant industry is my point.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, in committee we had testimony to this and the committee agreed that counter service jobs are lower paying jobs than table service jobs. And over the last 3.5 years, we've had a roughly 35% increase in the minimum wage. This has resulted in a decline in table service jobs being replaced with counter service jobs. Why we're providing a regulatory preference for lower wage jobs, I don't know. It's my responsibility to take the lessons the committee learned, the testimony we heard from those workers who are fighting to try to keep their high-paying jobs they have. It's my responsibility to convince your side of the aisle and the governor that this is the right thing to do. And if I need to, if we have to provide additional accommodations to provide other issues to make that happen, I'm in favor of that. I would just encourage members of the DFL to please actually read the language in that section and to recognize the fact that an expansion of the working family credit would be a far smarter way to achieve the stated policy goals that you've mentioned, as opposed to what we're doing right now, which is putting a regulatory preference to incentivize the table service industry to convert to counter service industry, which is going to result in the same number of jobs, but the wages are just going to be a lot lower. And there is no dispute on that data.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my only point, or my main point, was that the language is broader potentially than the restaurant industry. And I recognize fully the importance of the restaurant industry. I made that in my initial comments. But I'm just saying that the language here brings into play other employees in other industries or other job descriptions.
To that point, Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, and I guess I want to maybe comment to that as well. I think you know, Representative Carlson brings up a good point. I also own a hotel, and our housekeepers are occasionally tipped. And if I could put a shout-out to those hardworking men and women that are cleaning our rooms, we don't tip them enough when we travel to hotels. They are lucky if they maybe get 10, 15 bucks a week. Now, I would be a fool as an owner to pay them minimum wage. I can't hire anybody for that job for minimum wage. It's just too challenging. So for this kind of a wage and this kind of conversation with the two-tiered wage, as a reasonable owner, you would not be able to do that. And you wouldn't have any housekeepers if you really think you're going to pay the minimum wage and get under the radar with this. They wouldn't work for you. So my comments to that are, unless their wages literally are double what the minimum wage is and what their tips are, if you're not making 18 to 20 bucks an hour, you're going to have to pay those employees more to be there, because the tips then are just so erratic and not as counted on. I just wanted to comment to that.
Representative Carlson, did you have
anything else? I made my point. Thank you.
Oh, okay. All right. Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And just to add just a bit to this conversation, and, you know, there are a lot of ins and outs to this issue, there's no question about it, but I just wanted to say I don't see anything in this language that assures, you know, kind of responding to what Representative Baker said before about people who do the work in the back of the house, so to speak. There's nothing here that assures that the money would go to them. I don't know if that's an oversight or intentional, but there is nothing here that I see that assures that. I also just wanted to say that this issue came up when I was, I think, a freshman, when we raised the minimum wage in 2005 or 6. And I remember very well, I got a lot of contact from people in Rochester, mostly not constituents, but owners of restaurants. And there was a crying and wringing of hands about how if this minimum wage went in and there wasn't a tip penalty included, there would never be another restaurant seat built in Rochester. And this was going to kill the industry. And it was, you know, I was a freshman. I was like, oh, my God, what's going on here? Well, you know, what happened was we raised the minimum wage at that point. We did not institute a tip penalty. And anybody who's been to Rochester knows, I mean, even before DMC, the restaurant business in Rochester is doing very well. There are restaurants opening all the time, and having people make good tips doesn't seem to be putting a crimp in that. So, you know, I remain opposed to the idea of a tip penalty. I think that, you know, granted, things are changing. You know, maybe, who knows, maybe we should have a system where there are no tips and, you know, have the wages, the base wages be higher. I don't know if that's the way we're moving, but, you know, I really remain opposed to the idea of a tip penalty. I think that, you know, I've been a server, my daughter's been a server, my sisters have been servers, and, you know, if you're, and I think from the point of view of the customer, when the customer tips the employee, the customer thinks that they're giving something to that employee for good service. They don't think that it's being distributed. They certainly don't think that they're paying the owner of the restaurant more than what they've been paying through the actual meal. So, you know, I am very much opposed to that provision.
Representative Davids.
Chair Garofalo, is your bill in balance?
Mr. Chairman.
Chair Garofalo.
Chairman Representative Davids, yes.
Thank you.
All right. My committee administrator handed me a note, and he wanted to correct the record. Apparently, I wasn't aware of this, but apparently when Commissioner Stein asked to testify last night, I guess he did request to testify today as well, and I'm sorry I wasn't aware of that fact. So anyway, we've had a lot of different people requested to testify in a lot of different ways, and it's a little bit hard to keep track of it all at times. So anyway, I wanted to make sure there wasn't a misunderstanding on that. Any other discussion to the bill? Otherwise, let me turn it over to Chair Garofalo for closing comments.
Mr. Chairman, members, this bill spends $15 million above general fund base. Every penny of that goes into broadband spending. Any additional general fund investments come at the expense of cutting other areas of government. And the renewable development account, I'm very proud of the fact that we've been able to come up with a win-win opportunity. We're going to have the opportunity to reduce the cost of energy for Minnesotans while partnering with the Prairie Island Indian community to have what is really going to be a nation-leading project in terms of developing clean energy and energy storage to allow them to be zero emissions. It's a sort of win-win opportunity we all try to aim for here at the legislature, and I'm very proud of it. There's other provisions that I'm happy to discuss on the floor, but I'd ask for member support today. Thank you.
All right. See no further discussion. House File 4289, as amended, is temporarily laid over. Okay, members, at this time I'm going to bring forward House File 4099. I'm going to move that House File 4099 is referred to the General Register. If you look at House 4099, you'll note that if anything, this is kind of almost a technical bill. All we're doing on page 2, lines 1 and 2, is eliminating some obsolete language. And interestingly enough, I have a technical amendment to the technical bill, which is the A1 amendment, which deletes some other language that we found was obsolete, too. So, members, I'd move the A1 amendment. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Okay, so, members, we have House File 4099 as amended before us. And at this point, I'd like to move to amend House File 3719 as amended onto House File 4099 and have staff make any technical corrections necessary to accomplish that. This was the agriculture bill that we heard last night. Is there any discussion on that? Seeing no discussion on that amendment, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 3719, as amended, is moved with staff changes onto House File 4099. Next, I'd like to move that House File 3502, as amended, be amended onto House File 4099, and that staff make technical corrections as needed to accomplish that. This is the Environment Finance Bill that we discussed last night. Is there any discussion to that motion? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, for the benefit of the audience, I think some of us are probably not saying that much this morning because we made our points as the bills were presented last night. So in the interest of time and what have you, we may be quieter than what we're thinking.
Thank you. Sure. And this particular this particular bill was considered fairly late
last
night.
Told, yes.
All right. Okay.
But we did make our points last night.
All right. Then all in favor of House File 3502 as amended, being amended onto House File 4999, with staff making technical corrections as needed, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 3502 as amended is amended on House File 4099. Members, then I will move that House File 4289 as amended be amended on the House File 4099. This is the jobs bill that we just considered. Is there any discussion to that motion? See no discussion. All in favor of House File 4289 as amended being amended on the House File 4099 and staff making additional corrections as needed. Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 4289, as amended, is amended on the House File 4099. And finally, we have House File 4016. I would move that House File 4016, as amended, be amended on the House File 4099. Is there a discussion? This is the State Government Finance Bill. See no discussion. All in favor of that motion that House File 4016 as amended be amended on the House File 4099 and that technical corrections be made by staff as necessary, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 4016 as amended is amended on the House File 4099. And finally, members, then we have House File 4099 as amended. The chair will renew his motion that House File 4099 as amended be referred to the General Register. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of House File 4099 as amended being referred to the General Register, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 4099, as amended, is referred to the General Register, and staff is instructed to make technical corrections as needed. Motion prevails. Is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, members, we will be having a meeting next week. I don't know the time yet. We have a number of other smaller bills to take up before the committee that have come to the committee in the last week or so. And it won't be, of course, at our regular 10:15 hour on Monday because we have session at 10 a.m. on Monday. But I'll be conferring with the committee administrator on a day I would expect it would be sometime in the early days next week. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned a number of bills that are pending before the committee, and, you know, we have House File 1180, that's Representative Uglem's bill that passed transportation and public safety unanimously. That's the hands-free cell phone bill. Do you have a plan to hear that bill?
I'm expecting that we'll be hearing that bill at some point.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other discussion. Representative Carlson.
Chairman, you know, we're kind of down to literally the last few days of getting these bills into conference committee. Have you had any conversations with the chair of the Capital Investment Committee on when that bill might be before this committee?
I have had conversations with him, Representative Carlson, but since he's here, if you have a question, maybe you should ask
him. Well, I'm looking at your schedule is what I'm, as the lead Democrat here, as we look to the future. And the other question I had was the other bill that there are several important bills, but two major ones are pensions and the capital investment, and I'm just wondering what the game plan is relative to ways and means for those two.
Well, Representative Carlson, certainly as soon as, obviously, the capital investment bill has to pass the Capital Investment Committee first before it comes to us, and as soon as it does, we will have a hearing and make room for a hearing on that bill here. In terms of the pension bill, again, that has to come here, and as soon as the committee of jurisdiction has a hearing on that bill and refers it to us, we'll have a hearing on it. Representative Erdahl, Chair of the Capital Investment Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and in responding to Representative Carlson, the capital investment bill is very near ready to be presented to committee. Capital Investment Committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm generally aware of that, but I didn't want to speak for the chair. So I, but I was interested in what your plans were. But thank you.
Well, our plan is to hear it as soon as it gets to the committee.
And would that be true with the pensions, I think, is what you just said?
That would be true with the pension bill as well.
Because you did set the money aside.
There is money available for it, yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, seeing no further discussion, I wish everyone a good weekend. Watch for committee notice. We are adjourned.